Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, the cost of a decent retirement soars, so how will you afford it? Simon calls on Mr. Hunt to bin the 60% tax trap, a decade and a half and seven Conservative chancellors after it was first introduced. While he's at it, maybe stamp duty should be dumped as well. And does your work owe you $9,000? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade-in shares, funds, investment trusts and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, soaring prices mean that couples now need an extra £9,100 a year to maintain a good standard of living in retirement. A moderate lifestyle, so nothing too fancy, now costs a retired couple £43,100 a year. That's up from £34,000 this time last year, according to the latest report by the Pensions and Lifetime Savings Association. Retired households have been more affected over the past year than other age groups because of things that they typically spend on have seen the largest price hikes, including food, heating bills and travel costs. So, Simon, Lee, welcome. Simon, it's a pretty shocking rise, shocking figures here. Tell me more about this report and how much more retirement is costing us.
This is the Pension and Lifetime Savings Association's annual look at the cost of retirement. And it's important to bear in mind two things about these figures before we start talking about them. First of all, they exclude housing costs. So they presume that your average retiree owns their own home and has paid off their mortgage. That's obviously going to be something that potentially becomes less and less likely in years to come. But for the time being, that's a fairly accurate summary of what's going on. They're also after tax. So you do need to bear in mind that you'll actually need more money than this because you unfortunately have to pay tax in retirement, which actually many people don't realise. They just sort of presume that you stop paying income tax in retirement, but you are still liable for income tax in retirement. You don't pay national insurance once you're past state pension age, but you do pay income tax. So what have they told us? Well, the cost has gone up sharply, as you just said. A couple, if they want a comfortable retirement, that's probably the one that we're all hoping we get, £59,000 a year. A single person, £43,000 a year. I think many of us are probably more likely to have to accept a moderate retirement. And moderate retirement is going to cost you £43,000 a year as a couple. And many people will be in a couple. And the reason why the number is lower for people in a couple than it is of double an individual is because of the cost savings that you can make by living with someone else. And this is true in retirement as it is when you're working. The reason why the cost has gone up so much is because although inflation has fallen back to 4%, inflation for retired people is higher. The things that they are spending their money on have gone up by more. And so it looks at a basket of spending for people. And so for just to give a picture of this, so if you were looking at the comfortable retirement, for example, this would include things like £600 a year to maintain the condition of your property, £225 a week for food, including takeaways and eating out, a three-year-old car replaced every 5 years, a two-week four-star holiday and three-weekend UK breaks, and £1,500 for clothing and footwear a year. In the moderate retirement, you got £500 a year to maintain the condition of your property, £175 a week for your shopping, a three-year-old car replaced every 7 years, a two-week all-inclusive holiday to Europe, not four-star, and a weekend UK break. And then on the basic level, we've got £100 a year to maintain the condition of your property, only £58 a week for food, no car, you're using public transport instead, a week in the UK every year, although arguably you could probably go to Europe for less, And £630 for clothing and footwear per year. Now, some people will be listening to that and thinking, how much? I don't need to spend that much. I could survive on much less than that. Why do I need a new car every 3 years? Other people will be listening to it and thinking, oh, actually, I spend quite a lot more than that on some of those things. But what this does is it creates a good picture of what your retirement could look like. And that's the reason why I quite like these figures and I quite like this study. And I think it's a really good thing. But what it does show is quite how much that's going to cost you. Mm. And then you can work out quite how much you're going to need in order to achieve it.
I really like this as well, because I think that you can visualize. I think it's hard for people to think about. We don't really want to think about our retirement and stuff. But actually, when you start putting it into what you can actually afford, it makes retirement and pensions seem so much more real. But Lee, and I don't expect either of you to know the actual statistics on this one, but what does $43,000 a year actually mean in terms of your pot? What should your pot look like, you know, at retirement age, when you're 50, when you're 40, if you are going to achieve something like that?
Yeah, that takes a good data crunch, Georgie. Yeah. That data crunch is actually in the process of being done as a kind of spin-off from this story. But before I wade into all of that, you're right. This is a good piece of research in terms of it's good to be able to visualise what your pension would look like. But not just that, just how far off you might potentially be from having a retirement that's of any quality. So, you know, if you're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, I would really stand up and take notice of this and look at how much you really are on track to have the retirement that you want. Now, the figures factor in state pension, and state pension, as it stands at the moment, will cover a third of the required income for a moderate retirement of $31,000 for an individual. We've had some rises, obviously, in state pension, and we're going to talk about state pension in a little bit more of detail in a bit. So it does factor in those figures. But we got some numbers crunched in this article. So calculations found that a 65-year-old retiring today would need £356,000, essentially, to afford a pre-tax annual income of £31,300. I mean, that, you know, there'll be people that will be on track for that. There'll be people that will be well off of that. Yeah, as I say, you should put into sharp focus, you know, just where you're at with your own retirement. And then some other figures in here. A 65-year-old retiring today would need £574,155 in their pension pot on top of the state pension to have the kind of the very good, comfortable standard of living. So it gives you some sort of indication. And as I said, we'll be off crunching some more figures on this for a kind of spin-off article. And you shouldn't use this as complete gospel. You know, you shouldn't say, right, this is the target, because, you know, the goalposts are continuously moving, you know, because of rising costs. So the amount of income needed for a moderate lifestyle is up 27% in a year. And that's because of food, heating bills, travel costs. That's a lot. That's a big jump up in what you need to be having the kind of retirement that's just, you know, a moderate retirement. I mean, that sounds quite frightening to me. You know, so it's one of those things. I think it should kind of get you into, it should spur you into action, basically, and make sure we know this, and we've spoken about this in the past. Sometimes pensions get neglected. Sometimes life gets in the way, especially when you're in your 20s and 30s and you might be saving for a home, you might be starting a family. We're coming off the back of a cost of living crunch in which, you know, costs have risen across the board for household bills, potentially mortgage costs if you've got a mortgage, all of that kind of thing. It's very easy to go, oh, the pension, yeah, retirement, that's so far away, I can make up the difference. And, you know, you can make up the difference, but it just becomes harder and harder as the years go on. So my biggest takeaway from this is I think that it should be a kind of action point for you to go, I should really actually just spend a bit of time having a look where my pension's at. But lots of the pension providers these days provide really good calculators and tools on their own website, your workplace pension, where you can go and have a look, and it will give you forward calculations. And if you nudge up your the amount you put in by a percent, for example, you know, you the amount you would actually then end up with at retirement. So you should take advantage of all of these tools, use this as a gauge. And hopefully you'll have a better retirement.
Hopefully. Simon, I found it quite interesting looking a little bit more into the report. So we're talking about obviously the rise in inflation, but also you're saying about how older people, their greater desire to pay for treats and help out their younger family members financially following the pandemic is really interesting.
Let's take a trip back in the DeLorean, shall we? Not very far. So well within living memory, albeit many people, and collectively as a country, we appear to have decided to try to wipe it as much from our memory as possible. Lockdown was pretty bloody miserable for most people. There are some studies out there that show that there are some people who actually quite enjoyed it and would quite like to go back to it. But let's leave those aside for one moment. For many people, it was pretty miserable. It was pretty miserable even for the people that we were in lockdown to try and protect, the people who were vulnerable and the people who were older. And many of them were very, very, very scared by what was going on. Rightly so. It was a global pandemic. It was completely unprecedented, us going into lockdown. Never happened before in my lifetime, your lifetime or Lee's lifetime. And I sincerely hope it won't happen again. But also the messaging was one of fear and, you know, you need to be scared. The obvious reaction to that from people has been, well, life is for living and I want to enjoy it while I can. And I basically spent maybe 2 years, perhaps even longer, you know, locking myself away and worried about things. So I don't think it comes as any surprise that there was this willingness to spend on treats and things like that. And in fact, we saw this during lockdown in the pandemic. And this was one of the red flags for the inflation spike that eventually came, and the fact that we probably shouldn't have kept interest rates at 0.1% for so long, as we talked about at the time and countless times since. When people could spend, boy, did they spend. Couldn't get a hot tub for love nor money. Couldn't get a holiday rental in the UK. Eat out to help out. You can point the finger at Rishi all you want on that one, but it takes two to tango, or in many cases, three, if you looked at Britain's pubs and restaurants throughout the month of Eat Out to Help Out. One of this menage a trois was Rishi Sunak. Lovely thought, hey. The other two were the couple in their 60s who were filling up nearly every single table in every pub and restaurant in the country to take advantage of the deal that they were being offered. Then when you go beyond that, and you see that, you know, things start to open up, you can go on holiday again, you can go see your family again, you can go out, you can do things. It's hardly surprising that the older generation decided that actually they would like to maybe spend a bit on doing some stuff and having fun. And I think that that's quite right, because actually we worry about pensions and we're talking about the cost of retirement, but a large chunk of people in that older age bracket are actually comparatively quite wealthy compared to the rest of the country, and have quite decent incomes. There are lots of them who have defined benefit pensions, for example. And they're, you know, they've got properties that are worth lots of money, you know, and so on. There's the bank of mum and dad effect. And so I don't think it's a surprise that you're seeing that. And actually, you know, if you can do it, do it. When people worry about inheritance tax, the best way to beat inheritance tax is to spend some money on yourself. People really struggle with the shift from the accumulation phase to the decumulation phase. Ideally, in retirement, you need to be running down your balance, unless you've got some plan to just basically hoard it and then pass it on once you're dead. But really, if you're going to do that, better to pass it on while you're alive so that you can see the people enjoy it. So the best way to do it to avoid inheritance tax is to spend some money, spend it on yourself. Remember a financial advisor once telling me that he always told his clients that they should fly business class everywhere. And
love it.
He would say, what? We can't afford that. And they'd say, well, what if I told you it was 40% off? And they'd be saying, what? He said, well, it's 40% off. You've got an inheritance tax liability. When you die, unless you spend some money, the government's taking 40% of what's left over a certain sum. So every business class flight you buy, it's 40% off. And he said that very much changed the conversation. And people need to think a little bit more like that. And rather than getting involved in ridiculously complicated schemes to try and reduce their inheritance tax, they'd be better off, I mean, just spending some money or giving it away. And then hopefully they survive 7 years and it doesn't get taxed. But to go back to your point, it doesn't surprise me that people are wanting to splash out a bit more in retirement. These figures are worrying when you look at the size of the income that you need. But as Lee said, we have got some really good kind of number crunching going on behind the scenes for us for a follow-up. But as a back of the fag packet calculation here, and I should say, I do not have a cigarette packet on me. Okay. Haven't had one of those on me for a long time, right? So it's actually a piece of paper. Let's look at this £43,000 a year moderate retirement for a couple. Okay. Mm-hmm. So good news, state pension. If you're both in receipt of the full state pension, that's going to be £11,500 a year each. So that covers £23,000 of it, right? So this is good news, okay? That leaves you with another £20,100 that you need to cover. How much is that going to cost you? Okay, so being generous here and using the potential for a 5% annuity, right? You use both pension pots to buy an annuity, which most people don't do. I'm not sure you can still get 5% on annuity. I think that you still can. But the generally considered, if you're going to draw down, safe rate of withdrawal is 4%. Say you went a bit ambitious and you went 5% above that. And I'm going to explain why in a minute, right? Mm-hmm. You'd need £400,000 to cover that £20,000 of annual income that you need. And that's a £200,000 pension pot each. Sounds like a lot, but actually over a lifetime of saving, that is achievable. Again, if you look at the £59,000 figure, take off the state pension, you need to cover £36,000. You're going to need £720,000 in a pension pot between you. That's £360,000 each. That's a lot harder, going to be a lot tougher to reach that number, but it is achievable. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. So I think if people look at it that way, then it becomes slightly less scary. Though, as I said at the start, these figures exclude housing costs and are post-tax. So you need to take that into account. So those figures aren't entirely accurate. The other thing I'd say, and the reason why I think people can be a little bit more generous with the numbers and on themselves, and financial advisors would tell me off for this kind of thing, but I'm not a financial advisor. I'm a journalist, so I can say it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is you might start retirement having your comfortable lifestyle. Are you going to still be requiring that comfortable lifestyle at the end of your retirement? Or are you going to be more likely for your behavior to shift from comfortable down to moderate as you get a bit older, and you do a bit less stuff, you have less of an appetite for going places and doing things, and then all the way down to perhaps basic right at the end of your retirement years? And that means maybe that actually you're not going to need all of that money every single year for the rest of your life. The kicker is there is some things people need to think about. This gives a figure for retirement now. Inflation. You need to think about the fact that when you retire, it's going to cost more, not less. It's going to cost more. It's not even going to cost the same. Hopefully, though, what's also going to happen is your pension pot's going to go up from investment growth. And also, if you're still working and paying into your pension, your wages are going to go up. So you'll be paying more into your pension and so on. And that's why, as Lee said, I would use this as a starting point to then go and use one of the pension calculators that are out there that gives you a much better picture of where you might end up.
Do those pension calculators measure or take into account inflation? Because actually the forecast for 20 years, when you put it in the way that you've just put it, actually doesn't seem so impressive if you think about inflation. So does it take that into account?
Yes, the best ones do. And they go quite granular. You can go, you know, into quite a lot of detail. And what they'll ask you about quite often is what sort of percentage of your income now you think you will need in retirement, and work it out that way. But they will do that in quite sort of granular detail. But I mean, yeah, use them and actually read the bits where it tells you what it's doing and understand what the pension calculator is doing. That's quite important.
Lee, before we move on from this, we got some news this week, or we got some research that we might have to wait until 71 to get a state pension, which might worry a few people.
Yeah, it's not it's not the news, as in, like, this isn't happening. You know, this is a think tank that's come out and had a look at the state of play currently with the state pension. So it's the International Longevity Centre. And it's looking at the dependency ratio of those that are on state pension and the number of workers. So at the moment, it's at just over 50%. So just one, oh no, sorry. The ratio at the moment is currently about 3 working age adults for every person age 65 plus. In 2000, it was 5 workers per retiree. And a dependency ratio of 50% is 1 worker per retiree. It's projected for many countries with well-developed economies, including the UK, by 2050. So what we're saying here is there's going to be a very aging population and not enough workers to match, you know, the pay, the contributions that are being paid in. And that could really change the shape of what state pension will look like. Now, this is nothing new. This is something that's been around for a very long time. And there's been lots of, data and crunching on this. But what the International Longevity Centre here is saying is that 71, this age that they're saying people might have to wait for state pension, could happen as soon as, well, would need to happen as soon as 2040. Now, as I say, this is a think tank. This isn't anything to do with the government. This isn't something that is definitely happening. But it is a kind of interesting piece of research when you think about it in that way. And that's why, you know, the state of play and where the state pension heads next is always on the forefront of politicians and the country's mind, really. I mean, we've had a couple of quite big state pension rises, and it depends on who you ask. But many people say state pension is nowhere near generous enough. There are some people on the other side of the fence saying that the big inflation-linked rises of the last couple of years have gone too far. We've discussed that many times on this podcast, a very politically charged topic. But you know, it does really put into focus, you know, we've already got ages rising. We had this state pension age for women go up quite rapidly, for example. Currently, state pension age is 66. It's phased in to rise to 67. And that will, everyone that will be included in that, well, that will happen by 2028. So where does it go from there? You know, are there going to be more hikes on the cards as the population grows older, more of us live longer? And what does that mean for the future of our state pension? I mean, you know, get me back on this podcast in 2040 and I'll tell you, because we'll know. But it's interesting. And I think more kind of research looking at this and how it works, and all the checks and balances for state pension is scary reading. I think people listening to this and people that have read this are kind of imagining state pension at 71. The one thing it did for me, and I think it probably did for a lot of people that read this story, is it just made me think I've got to take care of my own.
Yeah, myself. Yeah, you know, absolutely.
You know, you've got to make sure that you are putting into a private pension. And, you know,
absolutely.
Long gone are the days of gold plated pensions for a workforce of anyone under a certain age, for example. And I think that there's quite a lot of people that have retired just on state pension. You know, current generation, I'm not saying that's everyone, but there's a chunk of society that have just relied on state pension and thinking that's going to get them by. I would say our generation, that's probably not a smart move. And the more that you can put into a private pension, the better. Now, there's always these rumblings on about, you know, when people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, whatnot, reach state pension age, if there's going to be, it's going to be means tested and that kind of thing. Of course, we can't look that far into the future. We don't know. But the one thing that you can really do for yourself is to be saving into your retirement pot and trying to take as much charge as you can with it, and to make sure that, you know, when you do, you know, and again, like, this is a, when you take state pension, whether it's 66 or 67, that you don't necessarily, that's not necessarily your retirement date. There's lots of people out there that will retire far earlier than that because they have taken control of their pension pot, and they don't need to rely on state pension because they've saved diligently over many decades. And we'll reap the rewards of that. That's the same for this. You know, let's say there is a scenario in which state pension age does go out to 71. That doesn't necessarily mean natural retirement age. If you've taken control of your own retirement, you know, yeah. the likelihood is you probably could retire at 60 or 65, and then that state pension almost becomes a bit of a bonus. You know, it becomes a bit of a kind of like additional money. Now, lots of people listen to that this ago, but I paid into my national insurance and my contribution for, you know, 35 years and whatnot, and I deserve that full state pension. And I totally, totally agree. But there's going to be some awkward conversations and discussions and decisions, I would argue, that are going to have to be made in the coming decades.
Right. That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan, Director of Financial Plans for Charles Stanley Direct, for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Today, we're going to look at how you can use your pension for tax-friendly investing. Lisa, investing in a pension can bring you a healthy boost from tax relief. How does this work?
You get tax relief on contributions within certain limits. What it really means is a 20% cost saving, a 40% saving, or a 45% saving, depending on your highest rate of tax. You can either contribute via your employer pension, or you can set up your own pension and contribute. Our self-invested pension is one way of doing this. If you're paying in via your employer pension, you'll contribute via payroll, and this should be from pre-tax income, so tax is never paid, and that's how you get the saving. If you set up a personal pension, we, or the pension company, will claim back the basic rate of tax relief for you and add it to your pension. You will need to claim back higher rates of tax relief via your tax return. It's an effective way as well of reducing the income that counts for certain thresholds, such as child benefit and the personal allowance clawback. The self-employed need to sort out their own pensions, and I really encourage them to do so. There's lots that can be done there and should be done. And the other aspect of tax efficiency is that any growth or income within your pension is tax-free, and also there's no need to add it to your tax return. So there, for those reasons, pensions can be really, really tax effective.
Thanks, Lisa. And we'll hear more from Lisa about investing in a pension later in the show.
Welcome back. We have a 60% rate of tax on our earnings. Hang on. Isn't the highest rate just 45%? No. And it's not those who earn the most that sort of technically pay the highest rate either. And it's been in place for the last 15 years. Simon says it's time to iron out this almighty kink in the system. Simon, you have tapped away on your laptop or whatever and got a bit irate again about this. 60% what? What are you talking about? Remind us how that works and why it was introduced.
Forgive me, regular listeners to the podcast. As I ask our regular readers on This Is Money to forgive me for this, because this is the umpteenth time that I have banged on about this. I have been banging on about this for nearly 15 years now, and it's existed for nearly 15 years. It was actually introduced in April 2010, but it was announced by Alistair Darling, set against the backdrop of emergency financial crisis measures in 2009. And it's the removal of the personal allowance above £100,000. Once somebody earns about £100,000, they start to see their personal allowance removed at a rate of £1 for every £2, until it is completely gone when the personal allowance has run out. Personal allowance is the amount that you are allowed to earn before you start getting taxed on your earnings. And at the level of personal allowance now, that band covers £100,000 to £125,140. In theory, people at this level pay 40% tax. In actual fact, due to the removal of the personal allowance, which in another way of looking at it is removing 50p of your personal allowance for every £1 earned, it effectively boosts that tax rate by 50%. So what people are paying on the next pound earned, so their marginal tax rate, is not 40% tax, it's 60% tax. And this creates a perverse scenario where our tax rates actually go 20%, 40%, 60%, and then once you get to 125,140, it now goes back down to 45%, which is nominally our highest rate of tax. But the reason why I think you're justified in saying our real top rate of income tax is this, is because this is actually how the income tax system is structured. The personal allowance and income tax are intrinsically linked. This isn't even one of those weird scenarios like the removal of child benefit or where student loans kick in or things like that that create high marginal tax rates. This is actually a fundamental part of the income tax system. It was slightly crazier before Jeremy Hunt decided to reduce the threshold for 45p tax, at the point when he did that, it actually went, the tax system went 20%, 40%, 60%, 40%, 45%, but it still doesn't make any sense. And just to give an example of how this works and why it's not the top earners paying this, you need to look at what you get taxed on the next bit of money you earn. This is what gets referred to as the marginal tax rate, right? So if someone earns £100,000 and they get a £5,000 pay rise, they will lose 60% of it to income tax. Whereas if someone earns £200,000 and gets a £5,000 pay rise, they will only lose 45% of it to income tax. I would argue that clearly this is nuts. This is no way to run a tax system. What makes it even worse is that since Alistair Darling introduced this in 2010, and as you said, Georgie, I wrote in my column, we have had 7 Conservative chancellors since then, and not a single one has done anything about this. They know that this is happening. What makes it even crazier is that that £100,000 threshold hasn't budged in all that time. If it had risen with inflation since 2009, it would now be £153,000. And there is a chart from the IFS that I tweeted today that shows how many more people are being pulled into this. Now, why am I banging on about this for the umpteenth time? Because we are less than 1 month away from the budget. And there are rumours that Jeremy Hunt might be trying to pull what I suspect is a too little too late move to try and sort out our tax system. So will he finally be the Chancellor brave enough to fix this mess? I sincerely hope so, because Jeremy Hunt is a smart guy. Jeremy Hunt knows this is happening. All of the Chancellors before him knew this was happening. Right. All of them know quite so how crazy this now? Is. Even Kwasi Kwarteng didn't do anything about this. You would have thought
that, he didn't get a lot of time though, to be fair.
No, exactly. And there's some other bits where this goes on. I mentioned the removal of the child benefit. Again, that creates a marginal tax rate for a parent with one child of 51% or 59% if they have two children. It affects people where one of the couple earns over £50,000 and all of a sudden they start losing that child benefit. Again, it doesn't affect everyone, only affects people with children. Whereas this is why I would argue the 60% tax rate is slightly different to that. But if that had moved up since George Osborne introduced it, it would stand at £67,000. And there's other bits in the tax system that are even worse than this, where you start getting things like student loans, the removal of free childcare and stuff interacting. The IFS pointed out after Jeremy Hunt launched 30 hours free childcare for all children over the age of 9 months in his last budget, that due to the removal of free childcare completely, once somebody earned over £100,000, where they're also then hit with the 60% tax, earning an extra pound could mean that a parent with a 1- and 3-year-old child in full-time childcare at average charges in England could see their disposable income fall by £14,500. So basically earn £1 more, lose £14,499. Mm. This is no way to run a tax system.
No.
And my argument against this, and the reason why it undermines the tax system, is people who earn lots of money pay lots of tax. Ideally, you would like them to be in the position where they feel that is their civic duty and that they are supporting their fellow countrymen and reflecting the fact that they have been very lucky in life. And just to be clear, by the time someone hits the 60% tax rate, they've paid just under £30,000 of income tax that year alone. Mm-hmm. So that's quite a lot of money. You're knocking on the door of they've nearly paid the average wage in tax alone themselves in that tax year. If you treat people unfairly on their way up, it most of them, it starts to really knock them off And then they start trying to find ways to avoid it. One of the reasons why I wrote this week is because we had a question to Steve about, could somebody pay into a pension to avoid this? And you can do. It starts skewing things. But even people earning £105,000 a year quite often don't have a spare £5,000 to stick into their pension just to avoid the tax. And there's also, again, no way to run a tax system. And the only other thing I'd say on this is what's quite interesting is the tone of the reader comments on articles about this have shifted in recent years. From a Sodom, they're rich, being the general tone in the comments, to this is totally wrong and we shouldn't be doing this. So actually, I think that maybe the time might be now to try and sort this out, because we have had a scenario post-financial crisis where politicians have spent all the years since terrified of doing anything with tax that might be seen to favour rich people, even if that tax is stupid. Maybe that might have changed.
We shall see. Lee, while we are on the subject of things that perhaps the Chancellor could take a look at when it comes to the tax system ahead of the budget, stamp duty. Your colleague, Jeff Prestridge, believes it is ripe for the chopping board. Can something be ripe for the chopping board? I don't know if I've just mashed two expressions together there. But either way, Lee, what's the problem with stamp duty?
Now you've got me thinking about ripe of the chopping board now.
Yeah, I know, it's all ripe for change, and then you know it's up for the chopping.
Yeah, I think I like it, but then I started thinking of like a moldy banana on a chopping board. So stamp duty is the Treasury take of stamp duty has just swelled and swelled. It's now at more than £15 billion at the last count. I mean, that's a huge amount of money. And when you kind of explain layman terms to people about stamp duty and the costs, there's quite often a bit of a gasp at just how much stamp duty is currently. So actually, I had a conversation with my wife this morning talking about stamp duty, and I asked her to guess how much she thought a stamp duty bill on a £700,000 home was. And let's just say she undercooked it quite drastically. And when I told her the actual amount, she was absolutely shocked at how much.
Which is? What did she say?
she said if she thought it'd be somewhere about £8,000, whereas it would be about £22,000. I mean, that's a massive, massive difference. So the way stamp duty works currently is up to £250,000, there's a nil rate. On the next £675,000, so homes between £250,000 and £925,000, the rate's 5%, and then it goes up a little bit further than that as you go up the scale. So yeah, it's quite big. For first-time buyers, there's no stamp duty up to £425,000, and then there's 5% up to £625,000. So it's not so bad. But do you remember in the pandemic, and what really kind of boosted the property market and what made everything go crackers was the stamp duty holiday. And lots of people did pretty well out of that. You could save up to £15,000 on the stamp duty bill. That is what I think is not needed, again, because it really shifts what people's behaviour. And the whole argument behind stamp duty and the reason why it's quite regressive and it's just not what it was initially set out to be is it influences people's behaviour. You know, whether that is taking potentially the next step on the property ladder, like me, for example, when I'm looking at what stamp duty bill would be for that next step up, it's definitely a kind of pulling point where I go, no, it's too much. Will there be another stamp duty holiday? Well, maybe I should just wait and see. You know, that's the thing. And I think that's why it's become such a bonkers tax. And then people downsizing as well. You know, the argument is potentially if you're going to buy your last home, like first time buyers, you know, should you have such a massive stamp duty bill? Because again, it influences behaviour. And if you can get people to move out of homes that are potentially now too big for them, for other bits of the chain to go up the scale, it makes quite a lot of sense. And a reform of stamp duty where it was, I mean, abolishing stamp duty sounds like a quite a big step, but changes to stamp duty, perhaps reducing the percentage. I know Simon has some great thoughts on this, and he'll articulate them to you. But the argument is that it would stimulate the housing market. And where the Treasury would be losing some of this tax take, it would be garnered back in things like VAT, where people would go out and spend on house improvements and that kind of thing, almost like another shot in the arm for the economy, instead of a tax in which the money just goes into the Treasury's coffers. People are kind of cross that they've had to pay such a big stamp duty bill for moving home. And I agree. I think it is ripe for change. I don't know about ripe for the chopping board, but it's ripe for change. And whether that happens in the budget, since coming up, Georgie, the budget, I know you've got it circled on the calendar somewhere and you'll be excited for it. It remains to be seen, but I can see the arguments behind it. And actually, in the story that Jeff wrote, there's a couple of views in here. So Paul Johnson, who is the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, describes stamp duty on house purchases among our worst and most damaging taxes. He says it gums up the housing market, keeps people who don't need them in houses that are too big for them, thus reducing the supply available to growing families, and it serves to reduce labour mobility. See, that's, I think, a very good view. And also the Adam Smith Institute says that change to the tax system to one without stamp duty would be beneficial.
Simon, you're going to articulate your views on this one, as Lee promised.
So firstly, just on the downsizing thing, I think stamp duty is an idiotic tax, just to be clear, and I would be very happy to see it gone, right? But with stamp duty structured as it is, what's particularly stupid about it is effectively it's a capital gains tax on property values, because it goes up the higher the property value, but one that's paid by the person who hasn't made the gain on the property. So it's paid by the buyer based on how much profit the seller has made on their home. It's not actually based on how much profit the seller has made on their home. It's based on what the seller has sold their home for. But most of those people, 93% of them, actually, statistics we looked at the other week, sell for a profit. And many of those homes were worth far less when those sellers bought them. Yet the buyer pays a percentage-based tax based on that price. Now, the only place where I think you could actually maybe be justified in doing that is the kind of top of the chain thing. So downsizers are the people who will have made the most profit, right? Okay, and then they're buying. So maybe, just maybe, there's kind of an argument that they should be paying on it, but it's not a capital gains tax, because there's already capital gains tax on property. You just don't pay it if you're selling your own home. So let's scrap all of that stuff that I just said and come back to the point of scrapping stamp duty altogether. It sounds completely crazy, doesn't it? Like, we couldn't do that. What, just get rid of it altogether? Well, firstly, let's look at two things. One, the thing we definitely shouldn't do is have a stamp duty holiday. We've had numerous stamp duty holidays over the past decade or so, and they're not a good idea, because they create a temporary scenario where people rush to buy houses before the deadline and they are inflationary. You could, I mean, I don't know why they don't just put them in economics textbooks and then put the economics textbook in front of the Chancellor and say, do not have a stamp duty holiday, because what you should do instead is you should cut stamp duty permanently. But should you get rid of it completely permanently? As I said, sounds completely crazy, until you remember that not that long ago, when Gordon Brown took over and started tinkering with it, stamp duty was a flat 1% on all properties. Didn't go up in stages, no thresholds, none of that stuff. Any property over £60,000, you just paid 1%. And we've managed to survive perfectly well with that scenario until Gordon Brown started tinkering with it, and then George Osborne tinkered with it, and then some other people tinkered with it ever since. So if we could survive perfectly well with a tax of just 1%, we could also survive perfectly well with the tax of just no percent, no tax whatsoever. And Lee's right, and Paul Johnson's right, and all the critics of stamp duty are right. It does stop people moving. There is an argument that people just factor it into the cost of their move and so on. But I mean, I genuinely would have moved at least one more time in my life if it hadn't have been for the fact that I was staring down the barrel of, you know, a stamp duty bill in the tens of thousands. And I was just like, I am not handing that money over to the government just for moving home more times in my life than I have to. And I know lots of people who would say exactly the same thing. And that's like real life scenarios where people would have moved home, but they didn't. They stayed and they waited until they could go that extra bit up the ladder. Stops people moving for work, hampers, you know, economic movement. It's just a bad, bad tax, and I think we should get rid of it.
That's it for part two.
I'm back now with Lisa Kaplan of Charles Stanley Direct to explain a little bit more about what you need to know about investing in a pension.
You get tax relief on your earned income, which for most people is salary and bonus, up to a limit of £60,000 a year. It's always your earned income in this tax year that counts, but you can carry forward unused 60,000 annual allowances for 3 years. And it's also worth noting that that £60,000 includes tax relief and contributions from all sources. So if your employer is contributing as well, that counts. There's a minimum amount available to everybody, whether or not they're earning a salary, of £2,880 per year, which they can contribute, and which will be increased by the tax relief to £3,600 a year. If you earn a very high income, or you're taking money from your pension, your annual allowance will be reduced. If you're taking taxable money out of a pension, your annual allowance is £10,000. If your adjusted income is over £260,000, your annual allowance in the current tax year will be reduced by £1 for every £2 your adjusted income is over £260,000. The minimum reduced annual allowance you can have in the current tax year is £10,000. The other important restriction is on taking money out of a pension.
And what are the catches there?
If you're born before April 1972, so if you're around 52, you can take the money out of a pension once you're 55. But if you're born after April 1970, you will have to wait until 10 years before your state retirement age. And you can check your state retirement age on gov.uk. It's also important to remember that there may be tax on withdrawal from the pension. The first 25% is tax-free, and then after that, it's taxed as income. So keep tax thresholds in mind when you're taking money out of your pension.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
Welcome back. Are you owed £9,000 from your work? Roughly a fifth of us are working at least 2 hours over our contracted hours on a daily basis, while just over half worked at least 30 minutes. Now, that's according to research from insurance firm Canada Life. And, well, it all adds up, doesn't it? So, what are your rights when it comes to overtime? Lee Boyce, are you on the clock? That's it? 5 o'clock rolls around, 6 o'clock, bang, you're off.
Oh, I wish, Georgie. Yeah, that'd be nice, wouldn't it? Yeah. Well, no, I guess the way the world has moved in the last few years means that it's gone a little bit more hybrid for a lot of people, hasn't it? Not necessarily everyone, but a lot of office workers. And, you know, the 9-to-5, it still exists, but, you know, it might be that you scatter your hours around a little bit more. You know, you might do a bit of 7 till 9, and then maybe you're doing the school run, and then maybe you're coming back. And I think most people make up the hours of what they are meant to be doing, right? But this piece of research is suggesting that actually 1 in 5 employees work at least 2 hours over their contracted hours on a daily basis. And 51% worked at least 30 minutes. That's according to Canada Life. And that works out at that £9,000 that you're talking about. So based on an average hourly wage of £17.40, if you're missing an extra 2 hours of pay per day or 520 hours over a year, you're missing out on £9,000. I mean, that's the headline. That's what's being kind of written in here. And actually, I went and had a little tinker around. We've got an underpaid overtime calculator that we can't share the link to for the people that are listening to this because it needs a good revamp. It still works, but it's in the kind of old system. But I was tinkering around with some numbers in here, right? So if you are earning £50,000 a year and you are doing 40 hours a week, and then let's say you are working an extra 30 minutes a day, right? Tap it all in. What you're being underpaid is basically £3,000. You should be being paid £53,125 if you were being paid for those extra 30 minutes that you're doing on a daily basis. If you then crank that up to, let's say, 6 hours a week, that goes up to £57,500. If you're going 10 hours a week, which is what this research is suggesting a lot of people are doing, you're missing out on £12,500 worth of pay. Now, it all depends on your job and what you do. But lots of people do get taken advantage of, you know, expected to cram in more work than what the hours that they're contracted to do could possibly allow. For one, lots of people feel under pressure, potentially, especially if you're in a kind of high power job, or you're going up the ladder, or you're looking to impress, you might end up going over and beyond. And then it becomes the norm, where you start saying, I'm going to do an extra hour here just to get ahead of the game. And then all of a sudden, you're doing that quite a lot. And you're kind of doing it off your own back and not kind of alerting anyone. I think that's how a lot of people go down this slippery slope of ending up working. So what the law says is that overtime is any time that you work beyond your normal working hours specified in your contract. But legally, your employer is not required to pay you for overtime as long as your average pay for the average of work is not below the national minimum wage. So if you're doing it off your own back, you're doing it off your own back. If you're kind of being forced to do it, well, that's a whole different kind of ball game.
That's sort of hard to gauge if you're being quote unquote forced. This is where I hate things like bonuses, because it's like there's an implication that you have to work extra and overtime to get that. Do you know what I mean? Like there's a pressure at work that you may not have it explicitly written down in an email saying, I want you to work an extra few hours on this tonight kind of thing. But
yeah, but I guess if you're in someone that's in that scenario and you are being asked and it becomes a more frequent and regular thing, you know, you should definitely note it down. You know, you should definitely keep a log of it and what you're being asked to go above and beyond, and either use that as arsenal for a pay rise by using a calculator like this one that we're going to get updated so it could be used by all, and you can use that as a kind of way of saying, look, hey, look, I'm sticking in these extra couple of hours a week, which may not seem a lot, but it is a lot more work for me, and I think I'm due this kind of pay rise. I mean, that is definitely a way of doing it. But it's, as I say, I think it varies from job to job. You know, there's some jobs where you end up doing overtime almost because you might be in a kind of like job where you're helping people, for example. The reason why I'm using that as an example is my sister is a social care worker, and she never, ever, ever really sticks to the working hours that she's given. You know, it is a thankless, difficult job. Council as your employer, which is just, you know, I've heard all sorts of horror stories. And she goes above and beyond, and it has just been sucked and soaked into her, you know, her routine. And where do you go with that? Because it becomes very difficult, because on one hand, you want to be paid properly for what you're doing. But on the other hand, you don't want to feel like you're letting people down. And another example I would say of that is probably a hospital. You know, you don't feel like you can just suddenly go, right, you know, it's 5 o'clock, I'm off now, bye. You know, you might end up just doing a bit of extra time just in whatever it is that you're doing in a kind of natural way. But then how do you claim back that time? And it just differs from employer to employer. But I think that it's, if you're listening to this and think, God, I do, you know, I'm on for 40 hour a week contract. Do you know what? Next week, I'm actually going to take log of how many hours I actually work. If you feel like you are sort of being underpaid for the amount of hours you're doing, you know, you should definitely take a log and try and haggle on your salary. That's what I think.
Yeah. Or when things are a bit quieter, you know, if you are a boss, maybe acknowledge the fact that your staff do work overtime, and when things are busy.
Yeah, but the trouble is, the boss is probably doing overtime thinking
it's a vicious overtime cycle
of admin and things that bosses also I think that's you know, one of those things, isn't it? You know, you ask your boss for a pay rise, but your boss has always got a boss, and it's like,
says,
you know,
editor Lee Boyce there.
Yeah, but you know what I was trying to say. It's a difficult one, but I think that this piece of research from Canada Life, it's interesting to kind of hear how much, you know, people might be getting underpaid, because you say, I mean, 2 hours a day sounds very excessive to me, but 30 minutes a day actually sounds not all that unrealistic. You know, let's say you have an hour lunch break and actually you only take half an hour because you feel like you're going to get behind if you don't do it. Lots of people do that kind of thing. You know, that adds up over the course of a year. You know,
the lunch break thing, I think, is a big one. People just eat at their desks.
Yeah, I do.
Is that all the time?
Yeah, a lot of the time they do. Or they might have contracted hours where it's a 9 to 5, you know, and they're finishing up at 5. But, you know, because of the nature of the job or some big projects going on, you inevitably end up working more like 7, 8 o'clock. I think that happens more often than what you think. I reckon.
All right, then, sticking with the business theme. And finally, Simon has been talking business with someone pretty big in the business world, haven't you, Simon? Tell me about it.
Yes.
Hobnobbing with business celebrities.
I caught up with Stelios, or Sir Stelios, I should say, of EasyJet fame earlier this week, and did a special interview for the podcast with him, where he was talking about his Young Entrepreneur Awards, which are open to those under the age of 35. And it's not like a Dragon's Den type thing or an apprentice type thing where he's looking to take a stake. He's actually giving away cash prizes and mentoring. The bar's pretty high for those who can qualify. You need to actually already have a successful business. But it's definitely, if you do, something worth considering. But I also asked him a little bit about his life and business and about starting up EasyJet and how we got started. And it's funny to think how long ago it is now, but also quite how much it's changed aviation. And we talked a little bit about that as well.
Let's listen to some of that interview. And the full interview will be available to listen, Simon.
Yeah, we're going to put out the full interview later this weekend or at the start of next week. So look out for that in your podcast feed. And if you don't have the This Is Money podcast feed, subscribe, people. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast from, because that really helps us out.
Well, here's a little bit of Simon talking to Sir Stelios.
The first thing to remember about myself is that I come from a Greek shipping family. So I've always been very clear that I'm not self-made, and I owe a lot to my father. My first and only boss was my late father. So I worked for him after university. I worked for him for 3 or 4 years. And then I think I had enough of working for him. And I think the definition of an entrepreneur is someone who likes to work for themselves, and they like to be their own boss, and they like to take business risk. So I said, I'm going to start my own business in shipping first, which was the industry I was brought up in. And then my first business was called Stelmar. You can see the use of the first letters, 4 letters of my name. I was very egocentric. I wanted it to be Stelios' shipping company, not his father's. And then I realized that in a B2B environment like shipping, it's very difficult to build a brand, a household name. I really wanted people to know my brand. So I was looking around at other industries, and I came across airlines. Again, a friend of mine was operating a franchise for Virgin Atlantic from Athens to London and back. So it was the one route, one aircraft franchise of Virgin. And that's when I started realizing the business of branding and franchising and, you know, owning the plane, but then someone else owning the brand. And I think it was the summer of 94 that I decided to go to Boeing in Seattle, sort of a pilgrimage in the world of aviation back then, to see how airlines work. And these guys told me that I should fly on Southwest Airlines, because back then they were the prototype, the one and only successful low-cost airline. And in the process of flying a low-cost flight, I stayed in a budget hotel, in a low-cost hotel. Until then, my life was very much five-star hotels and first-class air travel. So then I realized that there's a whole new world in America, because the United States deregulated the aviation industry about 10, 15 years before Europe, that can operate on the basis of budget. And I think the road to Damascus moment when I said, hold on, why is the budget hotel called Motel 6, for example, and the airline is called Southwest, which doesn't say anything about their price point? It's a geographical denomination of where they are. They're in the Southwest of the United States. That's when I started trying to find a brand that denotes value and also can be used on more than one industries, what I call brand extension. So I was sitting at a bar in London, I think in 94, and I was scribbling down names. So I said, Stel, my name. Then I crossed it out. It's not international enough. And then I tried a few others, cheap, affordable, value. And then the word Easy came out. And the rest is history. So EasyJet and then Easy Hotel and all the other members of the Easy family is what I do now for a living, if you like. That's my business. Unusually for such a big company like EasyJet, the airline, is, although they are on the stock market and we own 15% of the shares, but other people have invested in it, I own the name in my own private company called Easy Group. And that gives me a recurring income stream, a steady royalty income, if you like, which I use to fund my charitable giving. So the awards we're here to talk about today are very much funded by the royalties from the Easy Family of Brands.
Did you ever think that it would get to the stage that it's got to now?
I mean, Simon, seriously, if you asked me in 1994, I'd say I'd be happy if we get to 10 planes and survive and then stop. That would have been my business plan.
With the Stelios Philanthropic Foundation, which is what's behind the awards, crucially with this, there's a first prize of £150,000. There's a £100,000 second prize, £50,000 third prize. Those are paid in a lump sum and they must be invested in the business. But they're cash grants, aren't they? They're not paid with any conditions. You're not looking for a stake in the business or doing it in return for shares or anything like that.
It is not Dragon's Den or Apprentice in the sense that because we're a charitable foundation, we're not looking to take a stake in the business, and it's not a loan. It's a prize. You're good. You want a prize. The money is yours. It has to be paid in the business and used in the business. You know, don't buy a Porsche with it. Can you buy a Porsche nowadays with 150 grand? I don't know. Maybe you can. But you're not supposed to spend it on yourself. You're supposed to invest it in the business. But otherwise, there are no conditions attached. And obviously, we stay in touch. I mean, I will interview and decide on the winners myself, because that's how I always do it. And, you know, like with all the other winners in the other awards we're running, we stay in touch. We invite them to our events and, offer a bit of mentoring for what is worth. I mean, I'm not always right in my business advice, but I'm there to offer it.
Simon, talking there to EasyJet's Sostelios Hadjianou. Simon, just a quickie. What did you make of him?
You never know not what to expect when you're going to interview someone who is a successful businessman or successful person of that order of magnitude. And sometimes you are pleasantly surprised. And I was very surprised.
Oh,
well,
nice.
I wasn't pleasantly surprised, actually, because the impression I've always got of Stelios is that he seems like a pretty down-to-earth kind of person. And yeah, we chatted beforehand. And he was very nice and very down to earth and very happy to share his story and things.
Excellent. Well, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can tweet us at thisismoney. You can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, find all podcast paths, and you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. And if you do that and you want to talk about anything that we've talked about, you've got any ideas or anything like that, put podcast at the start of the subject line of your email and then we'll be easily able to find it in the inbox.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Charles Stanley Direct. Investing made easy. Cost effective and flexible. Using our website or app. With our comprehensive range of investments, trade in shares, funds, investment trusts, and ETFs, there's a range to suit all levels of investor. Choose your own or consider our ready-made solutions. Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.